morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies, inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman. Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since our founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope you had a lovely Thanksgiving. I hope it was quiet and peaceful and restful for you all, and that you got over the first part of the holiday season well. We had a nice quiet week here at Glucksman Ireland House. We were closed on Thursday and Friday, so it was a nice little break as we head towards the end of the semester. I'd like to draw your attention to an event we have coming up next Thursday. My colleague, Professor Nicholas Wolfe, will be launching his new publication, An Irish-Speaking Island, State, Religion, Community and the Linguistic Landscape in Ireland, 1770 to 1870. I'm going to have a chat with Nicholas later in the programme here. I want you to hear about this fantastic research he's undertaken on a study really of the Irish language and its speakers during a period of intense political, religious and economic upheaval in Ireland. It's, I believe, Nick's first monograph. We're all so excited. I haven't yet finished it, but what I've read of it so far, it's a really interesting insight into the vibrancy of the Irish language after 1770, which is a period which we usually see as marking the real decline of the language, and Nicks Wolfe really provides us a more nuanced understanding and causes us to question assumptions about the state of the language in that century from 1770 to 1870. It's published by the University of Wisconsin Press as part of their History of Ireland and the Irish Diaspora series, which is edited by two big names in Irish studies, Jim Donnelly and Tom Archdeacon. And it's great to see Nick's book in this series because it really does add greatly to our understanding of the language and of the intersections of it with the state, with the religion of the day, and with the community and linguistic landscape of Ireland for the best part of the 19th century and a little bit before. So I hope you'll enjoy my opportunity to chat to Nick about this publication. Not too long ago, I had the pleasure of sitting down and having a chat to Northern Ireland writer Tony Macaulay as he passed through the United States and particularly New York, promoting his new book, All Growed Up. Some of you may be already familiar with his critically acclaimed first novel, Paperboy, which was published in Ireland in 2010, and its sequel, Bread Boy, which was published in 2013. He's a very interesting insight into the life of a young person. The earlier books are more focused on him when he's really quite young, and as we move on into his adolescence and university period of time, it's really interesting insight into life in Belfast during the period of the Troubles. Tony graciously took some time out of his busy schedule and came in and had a chat to us about All Growed Up, so I hope you'll enjoy that interview too. It gives me immense pleasure today to sit down and talk to somebody I call a friend and colleague here at Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, Professor Nicholas Wolfe, who is Assistant Professor and Faculty Fellow here on our team at the Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. And what I want to chat today about with Nick is his new hot-off-the-press book, An Irish-Speaking Island, State, Religion, Community and the Linguistic Landscape in Ireland, 1770 to 1870. First of all, congratulations, Nick. Are you breathing a sigh of relief to be at this point in the process?
Yes, thanks, Miriam. Yes, absolutely. It's really nice to actually have it in my hands, and after a very long road from start to finish and to produce a full book, it's a lot of work.
And we'll mention this a bit later on in this chat, but it will be launched here at Luxman Ireland House, correct?
That's right.
On Thursday, December...
December 4th.
December 4th at 7 p.m. And all are welcome to attend, and you'll have a chat, I presume, that night, Nick, about the book and the process of researching it and things?
Yeah, absolutely. The idea is to give a little bit of a teaser of what's in it, maybe a little bit of talk about the background to how I came to write the book, and a little bit of what you'll find inside.
Is it fair to say that if we had to sum it up in a sentence or two, what it seems to me, and I haven't had the pleasure of reading it yet, we only have it here in the last week or two, but what you've uncovered complicates our interpretation of a quite anglicised Ireland in the period between 1770 and 1870. Is that correct? Could you expand on that a little bit more?
Yeah, so probably one of the periods that's least understood in terms of the history of the Irish language and Irish-speaking community is that period between the late 18th century and the 19th century. That is before you get a real active revival movement underway in Ireland, as well as places like the United States, Canada, and Australia. And so the idea is, what would a social history of that community look like at a time when the language obviously was declining in terms of percentage of the country that spoke it, and also a community itself that was facing immense changes in Ireland, in the religious sphere, the political sphere, economic sphere.
How did you get into this research, Nick? Can you tell us a little bit about the journey?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I get asked quite a bit because for myself, it's not an obvious path. For example, I don't have Irish family connections or anything like that. But, you know, I was trained as a social and cultural historian, someone who wanted to look very closely at the lives of everyday people, what's often called history from the ground up, right? Looking not at high politics or big, you know, economic movements, something like that, but really what happens to everyday people in a social and cultural sense. And so when I began work on Ireland as a historian, my initial question was always, well, what's going on in the everyday lives of people? And I found the histories of the period were very wanting. I mean, in general, social history of Ireland, you get little bits and pieces there, small studies that try to look at one aspect or another. But there's no real cohesive, large picture, particularly for even for the modern period, right, which is a very popular period for historians to look at. And further, my question in my mind was, well, do we understand anything about the good proportion of the country, even in the 18th and 19th century, that spoke Irish? And what was a social history of those people? What would that entail? That's what really what drove me to the topic. What questions would we ask? And you look around and look at what historians have said. And again, there's bits and pieces here, but I don't think anybody's really grappled with the question of what it would mean to write a history of those people, including looking at the archives for that time period in Irish.
Yeah, so you just mentioned it as an aside, yeah. Nick. But what this kind of research means is really coming to grips with Irish language sources, which Irish scholars in Ireland and those more closely genealogically even related to Ireland haven't all the time come to terms with, and it strikes me that we're missing out on a huge part of the picture without doing that.
Yeah, and what's ironic here is that there's actually very rich sources for this time period. We think of the language as being in a crisis, and there's definitely that's the case. But in terms of archival sources, there are quite a few out there. We have over 4,000 manuscripts that survived from the 18th and 19th century. That's a very sizable body. In fact, the majority of manuscripts that we have in Irish come from the 18th and 19th century by far. We also have a very rich collection in the National Folklore Collection, which many people might be aware of, collected largely in the 20th century, 1920s and 1930s, but from a generation that had grown up in the second half of the 19th century and had very direct connections with what had gone on in the 18th and 19th century. So fantastic body just of archival sources there, often in Irish. And I think even, I mean, it's interesting, there's a lot of experts, in fact, who know far more knowledgeable of the complexity of Irish language history, perhaps even than myself, but maybe have treated as self-evident the question of whether there's something to be gained from those sources, saying that maybe, you know, we look at it from a literary history or from a history of folklore, and that's it. You know, could we use, and that was the question I really came to this project with, which is, could we use these sources in a way that actually recovers that history?
Anyone who does any reading on Irish history or is an active or formal student of Irish history is confronted with the notion of the Great Famine as being a big moment in terms of the Irish language. Does the grand narrative or the traditional interpretation of the decline of the language linked to the demographic impact of the famine and emigration and things like that, how does that fit into the arc of it? Because, you know, it strikes me as it's not right in the middle, it's coming towards the end of your period, but it's certainly there. How does that fit into that?
That's actually a really interesting question, and it's something that my mind has changed in the course of doing this particular book. Sean Dufresne, who wrote probably the most notable book that sort of framed, in a way, our understanding of the language in this time period, in addition to a contemporary of his, Maureen Wall, had wrote about how the famine wasn't necessarily responsible for, in fact, it couldn't be said to be responsible for language shift and a lot of the changes that I outline here in this book, because they predate the famine. Right? You have these changes going on in the 18th century. And Dufresne had said, well, that's true, and we might even add to that and say, well, maybe the famine accelerated them. And going into this book, I would have said, I don't know, you know, certainly that acceleration was there, but I wouldn't have put such a big emphasis on the famine. But the more I think about the question, especially now, once the book is done and I've kind of looked at these issues, the more I think of perhaps language shift as entailing a number of shifts. So you have this large national level complication or endangerment of the language over 200 years, but you also have these sort of separate shifts that were going on at this more local level. So I think of what happened, say, in parts of South Munster, in Clare, in Connemara, those areas where you actually had significant numbers of Irish speakers before the famine, and then what appears to be an accelerated decline with immigration afterwards. And the more I contemplate that, the more I think of perhaps a shift within a shift, a much more accelerated one that took place on a local level and completely undermined the strength of the language, which in the very opening of my book I point out just how strong it was in places like Cork, and in Kerry, and in Galway, and in Clare, and many other of those counties in the West, where there was no sense that, you know, the language was in danger because they didn't have a picture of the national level like we have now. There were some speakers that may have been aware of it, but on the local level, most would have said, you know, the language seems strong. Everybody I know speaks Irish. And then to have that be so different by 1870 and 1880, where you have significant decline, I think that's increasingly, in my mind, it's something that needs to be taken a closer look at.
So it really feeds into, you know, we've seen this play out in other ways in terms of research that we undertake here, even amongst our colleagues here at Luxman Ireland House, Nick, in terms of the challenge of looking at the history of the 19th century backwards in the context of more localized sense of identity. You know, we were so overwhelmed by the national view and nationalism. And it's a real challenge for us to kind of go beyond that and really complicate and challenge and the viewpoint of people who were describing it. I think it's an ongoing challenge in terms of what we try to do as historians more generally.
Yeah, absolutely. It has to be foremost in your mind for anybody, historians or non-historians. When you look at the past, you're trying to put yourself into the mentality of the time period and also understand the different assumptions and the different perspectives. And again, with this topic in particular, we experience language as such a local and personal thing, right? We don't think about folks that we don't interact with, what languages they're speaking. We think about people around us, how they interact with us. And that becomes paramount in your decisions, if you can call them even decisions. Sometimes they're unconscious decisions on what languages to speak or how to interact with others. And that's something that, again, we want to be aware of. If we look at the past, the history of the Irish language, to be aware that local context, it really matters.
Another thing that strikes me, Nick, as we're chatting about this is how, for the most part, certainly in the last 100 years and probably longer, when we look at the experience of Irish emigrants and the diaspora, we see it through the lens of a people who only a minority had the challenge of linguistic acculturation when they went overseas. You know, they were predominantly English speakers, native English speakers. Are there any nuggets or insights in terms of the experience of the Irish leaving Ireland who were Irish speakers that came through in this research that you undertook?
I would say in this case, I wouldn't say that it had popped up immediately, but it's clear from my subsequent research and what I would want to do going forward with this project that it was incredibly important. Now, there's a little bit in there in the sense that it's clear that even those that were immigrating, and let's, as you say, would have known English even as a second language quite well when they left and wouldn't have the same problems of acculturation abroad as, say, someone who didn't speak English. But even so, they retained that love of the language. And I would say this is very clear. We have definite accounts of people taking their Irish language books with them when they emigrated. Now, immigration is a very disruptive thing potentially, and it's not something where you want to burden yourself with a lot of possessions perhaps, but here are folks who are willing to bring their books with them because it's special to them. So that definitely pops up in there. But what I'm finding, I guess, now moving forward with further research is just how clear the survival of Irish among immigrants abroad, how it was still there, at least in that first generation, to the point where I've begun making the argument with folks that I talk to, the point that by the end of the 19th century, you could really say, if you're talking about the status of the Irish language globally, that you have to take into account that maybe as many as a third to a half were outside of Ireland.
Right? Wow.
This would be native speakers of Irish would be outside of Ireland. Maybe using it in their daily lives, especially with their family members, maybe not. But the ramifications, I guess, for how we understand the status of the language on the eve of the revival movement is big, but not something that we've played out in our minds as to how that impacts our histories.
No, and our experience as immigrants, I mean, I find, Nick, I notice in my interactions with 20th century immigrants who are native Irish speakers, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong because this is not my area of expertise, and I'm coming from the perspective of an overview of their immigrant experience, but I think that there's a bit of research or a bit of digging there required in terms of the psychological impact or lack of impact, but I feel there is an impact for those who left Ireland up until and even till today, to today, who are native Irish speakers. That sense of loss I've found is quite palpable in native Irish speakers in terms of one other part of their identity, that as native English speakers, yeah, you don't have that sense of loss.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that there's room for research, and your book really fantastically brings that back chronologically in terms of our thinking. It's not just a 20th century phenomenon, obviously. In terms of, Nick, our listeners today getting a sense of the lives or worldview of some of the people you touch on describing in your book, can you give me some tangible examples of the evidence or the weight with which the Irish language, the impact it had on people's lives, things that might surprise us? Are there things that you could say we wouldn't offhand think of and you've uncovered in the book?
Yeah, I could say a bit about that in the sense that I think in general, when we think about that time period, we think of a language in crisis, and we know the numbers that the language was in decline in terms of percentage of the population. But when I looked at sort of the experience of that among Irish speakers and what we have left, little nuggets that are left in, say, the folklore or in eyewitness accounts of how Irish speakers behaved around other Irish speakers, what I was surprised to find was our understanding that is just the assumption that if it's declining, they must have some sort of discomfort with the language. It must be the phrase that's always put about the sense of shame about the language. Now, that's there maybe for some, but I would say the predominant viewpoint in the early 19th century was that this was an incredibly high-status language, that this was a language that had been a language of poets in Ireland. This was a language that was still part of the learned classes. And even, again, trying to put ourselves into the worldview of the time, maybe a question that doesn't pop up among historians, but what language, say, does God speak? Right? If you pose that question to an Irish speaker in early 19th century, they say, well, of course they speak Irish, right? And there's definite indications of that. So I don't think you can get a higher status attached to a language than saying that that's what God speaks, you know? So these are the anecdotes, I suppose, that I came across. Now, on their own, they don't say much, but if you put enough of these together, you start to get a sense of a different worldview than what we've assumed.
How long did the research take you, Nick?
Over 10 years. It was something that definitely took longer than, I think, your typical project, in part because the nature of it is that you're looking through immense number of sources just to find that one little piece. It wasn't an obvious type of history to write where you say, here's my collection of political papers, or this is my collection of organizations' documents, and you look through them all, however many there are, and then you write your history. This was something where I had to look at everything just to see if there's the one thing in there. So I can give you a very good example, which is that I found some of the most surprising and notable examples of language policy in the Irish and British state in road repair statutes, right? So road repair statutes, you would never think to look there. Why would there be anything on language in road repair statutes? But because the body, the local body, the grand juries that were responsible for upkeep of roads in 18th and 19th century Ireland, their allocation of money for roads also meant allocation for money to upkeep the courthouse. It also meant that they had to be responsible for money for interpreters deployed in the courthouse. So by looking at the road repair statutes, I was able to find out what salaries were paid to interpreters who were interpreting in courtrooms for non-English speakers. And that's something that took a long time to find. You know,
I can imagine. I mean, to use the classic phrase, yeah. Who knew?
Who would know? Exactly. It's cliche to say, but hidden history for Irish speakers in Ireland, both because we aren't looking in some cases, historians aren't looking, because the sources aren't obvious as to where to look, and sometimes the language barrier for certain scholars, and it's very difficult.
Well, it strikes me, Nick, that that's the best type of history, a long-term project where there's a, you know, there's a long gestation, and I assume, and how you describe it, it's clear there you've intellectually grappled with it and gone forward and back and or nuanced your interpretations and things like that. And congratulations, I really think it's a great example of something that's not rushed out, worked out over a long period of time, and involves serious digging through sources, a diversity of sources.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Well, I hope, Nick, that maybe you'll come back and have a chat to me again soon, because I know that this research has only served to whet your appetite further in terms of the Irish language, and you have your fingers in many pies in terms of some very interesting projects I think it would be interesting to share with our listeners. Just to reiterate, the book is An Irish-Speaking Ireland, State, Religion, Community and the Linguistic Landscape in Ireland, 1770 to 1870 by Nicholas M. Wolfe. It's published by the University of Wisconsin Press in the esteemed History of Ireland and the Diaspora series, edited by James Donnelly, Jim Donnelly and Tom Archdeacon. A fantastic series to be in. We're so thrilled and looking forward to the event on December 4th. The book will be available for purchase that evening?
It's available, yeah, that evening, and it's also available online now.
So,
by all means, take a look.
Take a look and come on to that launch. It will be a very special evening for us. Nick is a great colleague and friend to us all, and we're so thrilled, as I've said, to see his project at this point. So, co-ordinates, agus gurb míle maithre.
Gurb maithre.
Agus slán go fóill. I'm delighted today to have the opportunity to speak to an author who has come on the scene in recent years with a fantastic trilogy of memoirs of life in Belfast growing up in the 70s. Tony McCauley, welcome to Glucksman Ireland House, NYU. Your first time here on campus, I believe.
Yes.
And it's great to have an opportunity to sit down and talk to you, Tony. Can you tell me, so Paperboy came out in 2012 or 2013, was it?
Well, 2010.
It was 2010.
Actually, the
oh,
original,
wow.
The first edition was published in Ireland in 2010.
And then Bread Boy followed
and
when?
And then Bread Boy was published in 2013.
Okay.
And now All Grown Up is just published this month.
2014. Okay. Both in the US and in...
Well, actually, Paperboy was just published in the US in September 2013, so
okay.
It's just been published here.
Okay.
So Paperboy's on general release in the USA, mm-hmm. and the other books are available through... So Paperboy is published by HarperCollins
okay.
in the USA, and the other two books are distributed by Defoe Editions.
Okay.
They're published by Blackstaff Press, which is the leading Northern Ireland publisher.
Wonderful. So tell us a little bit, Tony, you've been in the United States on a few occasions and you've done some readings, but for the benefit of some of our listeners who aren't familiar with your work, tell us a little bit about the origins of this whole project.
Well, I mean, I hadn't written creatively for many, many years, and my work in Northern Ireland in peace building and community development and youth work in that field, and as part of my work, I write tens of thousands of words every year in terms of research reports and strategic reports and, you know, basically business writing. And I had done that for many, many years, and I hadn't written creatively really since I left school, apart from the occasional poem where I was inspired to write something. And I do some broadcasting with the BBC in Northern Ireland, but that's a very pared back type of script writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I hadn't written creatively for many years, and I decided to do a creative writing course. And during the course of that, I did some exercises around memory and reminiscence. And as a result of that, I started to remember various things that happened to me around the age of 12. I was growing up at the top of the Shankill Road in West Belfast at the height of the Troubles. It was the darkest days of the Troubles. But I was remembering simply what it was like to be a child and growing up. I was also remembering not just what I did, but also how I felt and how I saw the world, what my world view was when I was 12 years old. So I started to write some of these really short pieces as part of that course, and I got really positive feedback from my tutor, and she said, you really should write more about this. And I was just doing it for fun. I just enjoyed doing it.
Had you enjoyed, in school and things like that, had creative writing been something you'd enjoyed?
Yes, I'd always loved it. And around that time, actually the reason I did the creative writing course, my mother was moving house and she found my old school reports. And there are all these nice comments about English and about writing and all, you know, right from primary school, right throughout the school years. And I sort of, when I read through them, I noticed the pattern and I thought, I really should get back to this. And this is something I always loved to do and I was told I could do it well, so I think I'll get back to it. So as I started to write these stories of around that era, I had this idea, well, actually, those 2 years, which I'm remembering, that is the era when I was a paperboy. So perhaps I could write a memoir simply about those 2 years of my life when I was a paperboy delivering the Belfast Telegraph every night at the top of the Shankill Road. And that really was the start of it. And eventually I plucked up some courage to send a couple of chapters to just a couple of publishers, expecting that I would be rejected many times, and I'd sort of my plan of who I would go to next and then what I would do. And I genuinely had no sense of how good this was or whether this could ever be published. Mm-hmm. I had no real confidence about that. But a small independent publisher in Dublin actually found it in the slush pile, as they say,
mm-hmm.
and they sent it to the critic of the Irish Independent. There's something about it they liked, and they sent it to him, and he felt there was something in my writing that he thought was very interesting as well. So as a result of that, eventually they invited me to Dublin and told me they wanted to publish the book. And at this stage I hadn't finished writing the book.
And how much had you left to do on it?
I had 2/3 of it
left to do. Wow.
But having said that, once I got this positive feedback about my writing and they said they loved it and they wanted to publish it, and then as a result of that, my confidence grew and I just couldn't stop writing. Mm-hmm. At that stage, it just started to flow.
But you're holding down a day job, right?
Oh,
so
yes.
You're doing this in the evenings and weekends?
Yes. Well, I'm self-employed, so I can structure my week a little bit if I'm not too busy. So I was trying to write one day a week. Mondays was my day to write. I live in Port Stewart on the north coast of Ireland, and it's a beautiful seaside place, and I tend to sort of hop along the coffee shops at the seafront and just write for a whole day on a Monday. That would be the pattern that I developed. And really, since then, it's been a bit of a roller coaster mm-hmm. for me, because, I mean, I was just delighted that it was going to be published and that I saw it on the shelves in Easton, you know, the big bookstore in Royal Avenue in Belfast.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I was just delighted about that, but it never occurred to me that it might be published internationally and that it would get the positive response.
That you'd no inkling that you would publish a sequel or a trilogy out of it, right?
No, definitely not. But as it happened, then when I finished writing Paperboy, then I just kept writing. I just mm-hmm. continued. I had to find a slightly different voice for Breadboy because I'm 15 in that. It's a different era, but I am a little bit more mature and certainly more innocent. The books are written in my childhood voice. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're written from my adult perspective mm-hmm. today, but I try to write the books in that sort of innocent voice as I remembered things. So, for example, as a 12-year-old boy, the absurdity of the divisions and the violence in Belfast, I questioned it all the time. So there's a lot of that in Paperboy. And, you know, and I talk about how I wanted to be the only pacifist paperboy in West Belfast.
Mm-hmm.
But then in Breadboy, I'm just a little bit older, a little bit wiser, and then I had to sort of find a more grown-up voice again then for the third book, All Grown Up, because at that stage it's 18 to 20 years old and I'm going to university and I'm determined that I'm going to go to university and become something of an intellectual. So it talks about the ups and downs of and finding a sense of belonging and finding a place at university in those early years.
Now, Tony, here at Luxman Ireland House NYU, we have an oral history collection and we deal a lot with memories and oral history and kind of go, and for some people who write memoir, can you tell us a little bit about the process? How did you access those memories? Did you record yourself, or were there prompts? Did you go back and read things? Did you look at TV footage of the time? What was the process by which you kind of brought the examples you pluck out to life?
Well, I would begin with a period of time where I would just be attempting to recall, and I would write down major events or incidents that I do recall to this day. So I would start out with that, and that would give me a certain amount of structure. But then I would, while I'm doing that, that would spark off questions in my mind, such as, was that really that year? Did that really happen in 1976? Or was that 1979? So I do some research to check that I've got things right.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm checking what was going on in Belfast, what was going on in Northern Ireland. I'm sometimes checking with family about what was going on in our house.
Mm-hmm.
But then also I would recall music that I liked or television programs that I watched, and I would then go back on the search and check out those. And what I find is that it's almost as if every memory creates another branch
mm-hmm.
of memories.
Mm-hmm.
So I would recall perhaps something that happened at school, and as I'm writing it, something else pops into my head that I remember it happened around that time as well. And similarly, if I see a photograph or my father took old cine films in the 1970s, I see how we were dressed, and that then sparks off more connections to what the popular culture was at the time and places that we went and the music that we liked. And then there's a lot in the first book about the Bay City Rollers, because that was definitely the era, and they were one of the few bands that actually came to Belfast during the Troubles. But my father had taken old cine film of this youth club that my parents ran, and there we all were, bedecked in our white parallel trousers with the tartan stripe down the side, trying to look like the Bay City Rollers, and that sparked a lot of memories.
Tell me, Tony, you know, when you were writing and when you're going through this process of researching and kind of accessing those memories, is the conflict around you, is that compartmentalized in your memories, or is it just always kind of in the background? I'm not sure of how much the conflict touched your life as a 12-year-old and 15-year-old and so on, but could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's always there. It's always there. It's always there to some degree in the background, sometimes coming very much into the foreground. For example, in Bread Boy, I write about how our next door neighbour was shot dead and died in my mother's arms, and I watched that, I saw that. But most of the time it's just there, and that's how it felt, because I didn't know anything else growing up. To me, this was normal. And I think it's interesting because research has found that children growing up in conflict around the world, they don't know anything else, so they in some level assume that this is normality. So for me, that's just the way it was. You know, you got searched going into shops, there were soldiers on the streets, there were bombs going off, and there were people being shot, and the roads were blocked, and sometimes you had to walk home from school in the dark and on your own. And, you know, to me, you know, that's what everyone was doing. So I had no sense. I had a sense of some terrible things were happening around me and the horror of it, but I had no sense of anything else, really, as I was growing up.
When do you think, Tony, and you know, this might seep into your kind of quote-unquote day job in terms of what you do, when did you realise, or when do you think people realise that that isn't normalcy in terms of growing up in conflict? Was it when you went somewhere or talked to other kids, or, you know, travelling, or...?
Well, it was really only when I got to travel outside of Northern Ireland and you realised the rest of the world isn't like this. Elsewhere, there isn't this underlying sectarian divide which permeates everything, and there also isn't this conflict, this violent conflict and intimidation and being afraid that you can't go to a certain area, you can't go places at a certain time, and the security infrastructure and the peace walls. You know, it's only when you go somewhere else you realise life doesn't have to be like that. I mean, I write in Paperboy about our youth club. We were taken away on trips away from the Troubles, the little youth club that my parents ran, and they took us to Edinburgh. And we all queued. We were going into a department store in Princess Street in Edinburgh, and as we went through the door, there was a man standing at the door. You know, we held up our arms to be searched for incendiary devices, because that's instinctively what we—that's what you did going into a shop. And of course, the gentleman who just happened to be standing at the door thought this was bizarre. You know,
what are these kids doing?
What's this all about? So I think, yeah, but even at that time, I think because growing up, you know, my generation who grew up in the Troubles and don't really remember before the Troubles, there was this sense that this was going to go on forever. There was no end to it. I write about that in All Growed Up, where, you know, I'm 19 and I've known nothing else, and there's a sense of weariness about it. In Paperboy, I write about one of the peace rallies with the peace people, where the 20,000 women marched for peace from the Falls and the Shankill Road, and my mother was in the march, and I watched that. And this great sense of hope the Troubles would be over soon, that this was the future, this sort of reconciliation was the future. And sadly, it was, you know, we had a long way to go, and a lot more people died after that. But in All Growed Up, I write about this weariness, the growing sense of anger about it, and also a sense of, should I stay or should I go? Do I really want to live in a place like this? And I suppose for me, that has been a choice, because I've actually started writing the next instalment, which is actually a period where I did something unusual, because out of my sort of idealism around peace building, actually when my wife and I got married, we went and lived on the peace line. You know, we chose to go and live on the peace line as a sort of deliberate attempt to bring young people from the two communities together. And that was an unusual thing to do at the time, quite an idealistic thing to do at the time. And it was a dark period in Belfast, that some terrible things happened, and terrible things happened to some of the young people that we worked with as well. Yeah, so it's really only since the ceasefires and the peace process that you really have a sense.
Yeah, that's what struck me, Tony, as well, in thinking about these books and your writing. These could only be written in a post-Good Friday Agreement or some kind of peace, right? Because the space is there now somewhat to actually you know, psychologically for people to step back and reflect and just to have the security of being able to write this stuff in a way that you don't feel threatened necessarily.
I think that's true. I mean, I'm a Protestant from the Shankill Road, and there's things that I say in my childhood voice about coming from that background, which I suppose is questioning and critiquing aspects of my political and cultural and religious background. And in a sense, I can do that now. And also, by speaking in my childhood voice about what I thought about some of that back then, which I would never have dared to articulate mm-hmm. to the wider community because of the repercussions, mm-hmm. I think there is a space to do that now. And similarly, I think it's really interesting that, you know, I also questioned republicanism mm-hmm. and the violence of the IRA as a child, and there's a space to do that as well. And I've really loved the fact that that's been welcomed. You know, I did a reading from Paperboy at the Phelan Phobo, you know, the West Belfast Festival, mm-hmm. that they're scribes at the West event. And I've done a series of book readings with Danny Morrison. And, you know, this would have been unthinkable. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did that reading in the West Belfast Social Club, which to me, growing up, would have been a place that I'd gone into. I wouldn't have got out alive. That mm-hmm. was my perception mm-hmm. of it. And I have had a lovely, warm welcome there. And people come up to me afterwards. And people have written to me and sent me messages on Facebook who grew up literally a mile away from me in the other side of the peace wall and said, we had no idea, you were just growing up the same as us. Mm-hmm. And in some way, being able just to read about it in a book as a child, what a child has experienced. And they, you know, they discovered that I was watching the same TV programs and I was having trouble getting my first girlfriend. And, you know, we had so much in common, and yet, you know, we were never to meet. Mm-hmm. We weren't going to meet. We were separate schools. There was a wall dividing us. There was a risk to cross into that wall at the time. And so there's a space now where we can sort of start to share these stories and maybe get a fuller understanding of all that's going on.
I'm interested as well, Tony, to hear about, it's really interesting to hear about responses in the communities at home, but what, in terms of your travels, this wonderful international acclaim that your writing has received, what have the responses been like in Irish communities abroad? Is there any pattern, or is there a particular way with which people engage with what you're writing about?
I think what I find interesting when I've been here in the United States is a sense of curiosity. They don't always realise it at first, but once the penny drops, this is a writer from a working class Protestant background mm-hmm. in the North, and there aren't very many of us. Mm-hmm. And once people notice that, there's a curiosity there. And also, perhaps I as an individual don't fit perhaps what their stereotype of someone from the Shankill Road is. So that's a very interesting dynamic that I've experienced here, and I get really stimulating conversations. I mean, I was at a school in Pennsylvania earlier this year, and the teacher said to me, look, we haven't really done Ireland yet, so you need to give them a little bit of context at the start. So I give a little bit of context and a little bit of context to the history and the trouble, and then I read a section that I thought they would just relate to as 14-year-olds. And then I opened it up for questions, and this 14-year-old, who sort of slouched a little bit at the back, put up his hand, and his first question was, do you think that Bobby Sands was a terrorist or a visionary? And, you know, that kept me on my toes. So that sense of younger people, a lot of the readings and lectures that I've done were here being with young people, and I just love their fascination. Some of them are interested in the creative writing, the writing process, all of that, but others are interested in sort of the social history or trying to understand Irish mm-hmm. history. But there is this, yeah, there's this sort of curiosity.
What I find as well, Tony, you know, I teach older kids, slightly older kids than, you know, what you probably mm-hmm. are interacting with or describing mm-hmm. there. But what I find interesting, and less so for me because I'm a little bit younger than you and I grew up in the South, yeah. but it's sometimes when I hear the questions of American students and the simplicity of the questions in terms of when you grow up there and you're so embedded in all the cultural and historical context, and when you hear these kids asking you these questions, and to me I find it kind of provocative and saying, you know, how ridiculous was it really? You know, that kind of way. You don't think that because you've come out of it, you've been too close to it in a certain way?
I find it very stimulating and at times quite challenging. And for example, last week when I was in Indiana in Goshen College, a student asked me, had Seamus Heaney in any way influenced my writing? And my writing is very different, obviously, from Seamus Heaney's, but there is something that I answered in answer to that question that I feel a very strong affinity with Seamus Heaney on, in that he was very clearly rooted in his culture and his background and his religious and political background. He was very much rooted in that, but he managed to, in the way he wrote, he managed to transcend the divisions And we talked about perhaps, you know, getting underneath the divisions, mm-hmm. and going around the divisions, mm-hmm. and transcending above the divisions. And I really relate to that, because that's what I try to do as well. And I'm really not interested in sort of giving one side of a story. I'm interested in just telling my story, mm-hmm. and how I saw things and how I see things. But I was stimulated to articulate that.
Mm-hmm.
By a student who had been obviously studying Seamus Heaney, mm-hmm. in Goshen College in Indiana,
mm-hmm.
and it helped me. That will influence how I write in the future, mm-hmm. just having that sort of in some way affirmed.
Mm-hmm. One of the things when I was reading Paperboy that struck me as well, Tony, was, and you've touched on this a little bit, but I'd like you to like expand a little bit more on it or give me your thoughts on it, this universality of the child's experience. And, you know, you think of these kids in places like Syria and mm. places like this today, you know, mm. Gaza or other parts of the world. Do you think that that's what has resonated as well in terms of the universality of a child's experience growing up in conflict, or how a child's voice comes out of this kind of horrendous situation that he or she is growing up in? Do you think that that's how people even not familiar with Irish history kind of are able to relate to the child's voice in it?
I think many people can relate to their version of that when they were a child. And it may have been just something that was going on in their family, mm-hmm. or something in their community, or perhaps just something that happened as they were growing up that, you know, as an adult they now look back and they know that wasn't right, or there was something seriously wrong going on there. However, as a child, they're not fully aware of just how perhaps traumatic or out of the ordinary that really is, although instinctively they question it. And they remember questioning it in the same way that I instinctively questioned being told that the people on the other side of the peace wall were all bad.
Mm-hmm.
And as a child, I just thought, well, I mean, they couldn't all be bad. You know, are they being told that we're all bad on this side?
Mm-hmm.
And I know we're not all bad, mm-hmm. on this side, mm-hmm. so it's got to be the same on the other side. And that's a very simple, that's a very innocent and simple view of things. But it's actually an accurate, you know, it's a pure, innocent view that hasn't been sullied by the sort of the adult interference of, mm-hmm. there's a conflict going on here and we're on the right and the other side are in the wrong, and in some way we're better or superior, mm-hmm. or, you know, all of that seeps in from perhaps the subtle and not so subtle voices at home, or perhaps from teachers at school, or perhaps in church or on the streets, or, mm-hmm. or wherever. That's where the prejudice starts to be built up.
It strikes me though as well, Tony, and I know there are external influences on a child, but especially in Paperboy where you're a bit younger and stuff like that, the influence or the worldview that was constructed around you on the basis of your parents, who were obviously people who, there was a certain climate or environment in your home in terms of how your worldview even at that point was constructed. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about, or am I overstating that, in terms of how their worldview in a sense is permeating into what you write in Paperboy because of the home that they have for you, that, yes. you were growing up in?
Well, it is, but even when I was writing it, I wasn't fully aware of that. It was part of the process of writing that where I really understood that fully, mm. for the first time. So, well, there were two things. First of all, they would do anything for me to get an education. And the Shankill Road to this day has the lowest level of educational attainment in Northern Ireland. And very, very few kids from the Shankill Road go to a grammar school and get to go to university. Well, my parents were absolutely determined that that's what would happen to their children. That was more important than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the first thing. But the second thing is, they also were determined to create a sort of a sense of normality for us. And so they got involved in starting this youth club, mm-hmm. in the church hall. It was a disco called the Westie Disco. And really, they were trying to keep kids off the street and safe at the height of the Troubles. There were 400 of us packed into a little tin Nissan hut every Saturday night, dancing away to the Bay City Rollers and then later on the Bee Gees and all the rest of it. But it was really only as I was writing that, as I was writing Paperboy, that I understood, well, you know, so that's what they were doing in the 70s to keep us safe and to give us a sense of normality. And I think that little youth club saved lives, because we were in there and we were safe. It meant we were less likely to get involved in paramilitaries, less likely to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And, well, that's the work that I've worked in all my life,
mm-hmm.
youth work and peace building and community development. And really, it was only as I was writing Paperboy that I really understood that actually my parents did inspire me to do that. You know, you have this sense when you're a teenager that you're creating your own pathway, you're your own person, and you're not like those parents, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I've discovered that very much they've influenced and inspired me. I mean, my father died in 1986. In a sense, I never got a chance to tell him that.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it's lovely now. I might be doing a book reading in New York or somewhere like that, and somebody says, I really like your father. He was really determined that you were going to get an education. Or, I loved his independent-minded spirit that I write about, where he worked in a foundry as a foreman, and he gave a job to a Catholic, and the next day he got bullets in his locker, a sort of intimidation, you know, for doing that. Mm-hmm. But he should have given that job to mm-hmm. a Protestant, and he wasn't intimidated by that at all. Mm-hmm. He's that sort of strong, independent-minded sort of person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I love to hear now people appreciate and my father.
He lives on in the
And that little Westie disco, you know, it is bizarre to be in Pennsylvania and people saying to me, you know, last week, oh, I love the Westie disco. And there's a reunion of the Westie disco in Belfast in November. And, you know, I go to the reunions and I say, you won't believe this, but there are people in America who just love what we did at the Westie disco.
It's such a small world in a way. Well, listen, Tony, before I let you go and go out and enjoy a little bit of New York before you take off again, would you mind reading an extract from one of the books? I'll leave it up to you to choose and let people hear, for any of those who haven't heard you read, some of this great stuff you've written in Paperboy, I guess you're going to look at, is it?
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much for inviting me here today, and it's been really lovely. Thanks very much.
Appreciate Not at all, Tony. It's our pleasure. And I hope that people will be inspired to go out and purchase. Just to be clear, Paperboy is the first in the sequence, and then Bread Boy and All Growed Up, and they're all available here in the United States, so they're well worth the read. So we'll hear Tony now read from Paperboy.
So this is the introduction to Paperboy. I was a paperboy. This never made it to my CV. So just for the record, the dates of employment were 1975 to 1977. The place was Belfast. I delivered the evening Belfast Telegraph, 48 belly tellies each night in the darkness. Belfast in the 70s was like the newspapers I delivered. Everything was black and white, albeit orange and green. Everything got smudged and ruined like dark ink from the stories that dirtied my hands every day. But there were splashes of colour too, like in the weekly glossy magazines I provided to the more affluent customers of the Upper Shankill. I was a paperboy, aged 12, thin and easily crumpled, blown around the streets by greater forces, more smart than tough. Yearning for peace, but living through troubles. And yet, as you will learn in these slightly less fragile pages, I was happy with my calling. I was a good paper boy. I delivered.
That's great, Tony. Thank you so much for coming in today. And hopefully, how close to completion, or where are you in the next book, or is it too early to ask that question?
I'm at that very early stage where I'm getting all the ideas together and remembering everything that happened in that era, so it might be a little while before.
Well, we look forward. Hopefully we'll see you when it comes to fruition. I'm confident it will at the rate you're going. Thanks a million, Tony.
Thanks very much, Maya. Bye.
I'm here sitting with Gregory Harrington, who has just popped in to us to share with us some exciting news in his career. For any of you who are not aware, Gregory, you've been here in New York for how long, actually?
I've been here quite a while, actually, now. I'd say I came over in 99, and I went to college here and won a competition to do my Carnegie Hall debut. That was about 2003, so it's been a little while.
Wow. Well, yeah. You're practically a New Yorker now, Gregory.
I am indeed.
So tell me what is coming up now. You've a busy couple of weeks.
I do. I've got a very busy couple of weeks, and it's very exciting. I'm releasing my third disc, my third CD, my third album, and it's unaccompanied Bach, and it's some of the most beautiful classical music that Bach wrote. And this, it's different from other Bach CDs because it's transcriptions for solo violin that I've done. For example, that famous Toccata and Fugue that you'll hear in many movies, or that little opening of Andrew Lloyd Webber, Phantom of the Opera, you know, that famous piece for organ, I've transcribed that for solo violin. That beautiful Bach prelude for the cello suite that Yo-Yo Ma made so famous, millions and millions of hits on YouTube for that. That's recorded for violin. I arranged that for violin. And another example would be the Goldberg aria. You know, I was watching that goes in through movies and whatnot. So it's some beautiful Bach music that's been transcribed for violin. And a lot of these are premiere recordings. They haven't been done before. And so it's transcriptions and variations. The transcriptions are mine. And then there's one or two of Bach's iconic pieces for solo violin, like the Bach Chaconne. So that really rounds out the album. It's something I've been playing for about 20 years. So it's exciting. It's beautiful. It's basically a combination of 20 years of work on stage throughout, you know, say 5 continents, but I've only been to 4, so 4 continents.
So Bach has been a major influence, or you've loved playing that music for a long time?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, absolutely. Ever since I was 2014-15. But I mean, you'll see it, and I'm doing this show, I'm releasing it in the Irish Arts Centre, and it's a fascinating show in the Irish Arts Centre because I'm doing a lot of jazz and standards from that. And you know, you take something like Leonard Cohen, Hallelujah, or you take, let's say, my favourite thing is John Coltrane. That is a very, you know, it's the same structure. That is what Bach did, you know, 200-300 years ago. So it's, for me, putting those two together is actually quite a logical choice, whereas, you know, it's not what you would necessarily juxtapose together.
So his influence is massive. I know I listened to some of the little clips, and sometimes we've heard these tunes so often, Greg, in other contexts, that you forget that they were actually written so long ago by this great master.
You know, this incredible master. I mean, some of these were written at the early 1700s to about the mid, you know, 1720s. And I mean, the one thing about Bach is, although the music is very Baroque in the nature, I mean, Bach was a very passionate composer. He had 20 children. There is just fire and beauty in his music. It's really, it's phenomenal.
So your CD, which is called Bach Transcriptions and Variations by Gregory Harrington, will be released on December 2nd at the Irish Arts Centre?
Yes, it's going to be released on December 2nd at a release there. There's a few tickets left for that concert, and it's wide sale available on one site, CD Baby. You can find that information on my own Facebook site, but the reason I did that was because I'm pushing for Billboard this week.
And so to the uninitiated out there, Greg, explain the significance of Billboard and what you're actually trying to do, because I think it's quite significant in the context of so much music that comes at us here in this city that is traditional.
Yes.
For what you're doing is quite different and important in its own right.
Well, I mean, you know, I was the first violinist to give a full solo to Boone Carnegie, and I've been always wanting to just make a musical name and just be the first one to do a lot of things. So Billboard is where all the classical artists, actually every artist, get listed, from Mariah Carey to Sting to everything. So this is the classical chart, and there has only been, from what I know, two Irish artists that have ever charted pretty high in the classical charts, the Irish tenors being one, and Barry Douglas, the incredible Irish award-winning pianist. So I want to become the first violinist to chart at such a high. So my competition is Andrea Bocelli and artists like this, releasing all for December. So, you know, it's a goal. It's about putting Irish arts on the map, and not just Irish music, but Irish artists performing on the map. And it is regarded as an incredible sounding board. It's just, it's something phenomenal.
Right. So for people who would like to get behind you and show support, which I think is a really worthwhile endeavour, I've had the pleasure of seeing you perform live. Greg, in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention, provided some of the wonderful musical entertainment at our Duxman Ireland House NYU Gala earlier this year. So for people to support you in terms of this goal of your rating on the Billboard charts, you have to purchase the album between December 2nd and the 7th.
The morning of December 2nd, which is Tuesday, until midnight on Sunday night. That way it'll get counted for the Billboard charts. And what I'm doing is I've given a 25% discount on prices that Amazon have and that iTunes have, just for incentive to people. This is not truthfully about money. It's about units, 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 units. And for those that buy more than one or two CDs, I've given a 10% discount on that as well. So,
and that's via CD Baby.
CDBaby.com, Gregory Harrington. And the album is Transcriptions and Variations.
So just to explain, listeners, and Greg was explaining to me earlier, the reporting purposes for some of the other platforms by which one might purchase music report later, so that it won't count for the Billboard chart. So I have to say, I have had the opportunity to listen to some of the snippets from this album. It really does sound stunning. I'm holding back until next week to purchase my own copy
and some other gifts
that I will purchase over. It's a lovely gift to give people,
It's a lovely gift. And for those that love classical music, they will adore this. You know, so parents, relatives, family, corporate gifts, anything in that little window will just be, it will be putting Irish arts and Irish arts on a global map.
Well, listen, Greg, it's great to have an opportunity to talk to you about this. On behalf of us all here at Luxman Ireland House NYU, I'd like to wish you the best of luck. I do urge people to consider going to CD Baby next week and purchasing Bach Transcriptions and Variations by Gregory Harrington. It's a good investment, and hopefully at some point when we have more time and you're less frantic, we'll have a longer chat and talk about what you've done here and what you're continuing to do. It seems like it's onwards and upwards. So best of luck next week, Greg. Thanks for coming in
to
us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Not at all.
Hi, I'm John Waters. I'm the director of the MA program in Irish and Irish American Studies at Glucksman Ireland House at New York University. This is an interdisciplinary MA programming encompassing the study of history, literature, music, language, and culture. We're now accepting applications for fall 2015, and generous scholarship money is available. We'd like to invite you to visit Ireland House for an MA program open house with faculty, current students, and alumni. That'll be held on Friday, December 12th from 5 to 7 p.m. Hope to see you there.
Before we finish up, folks, I would like to draw your attention again to our event next Thursday, December 4th, with Nick Wolfe as we launch his new book, An Irish-Speaking Ireland, State, Religion, Community and the Linguistic Landscape in Ireland, 1770 to 1870. I'd also like to draw your attention to the last few events that we have here at Luxman Ireland House this semester. On December 11th, that's Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m, we'll have our annual Ornall na Nollag. That's our Christmas concert. Padraig O'Carroll, our senior language lecturer, will host an evening of traditional music and song with NYU students and local musicians. It's always a very popular evening and a great event, so do feel free to be in touch with us about attending that event. For any of you also interested, we heard our little promotion from Professor John Waters, the director of the graduate program. Just to remind anyone interested, we will have an open house about our Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies on Friday, December 12th from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. And that will be followed later in the evening with the last Blarney Star concert of the season. New Jersey fiddler Willie Kelly will perform with his wife Siobhan and really show some great talent in the fiddle style. So that will be at 8 p.m. on December 12th. That's a Friday. So we are at the end of the program now for another week. I can't believe it, but it always seems to come on top of us very quickly. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time. And in the meantime, if you'd like to be in touch with me, my email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu, and myself or my co-producer Jamie Sweeney will pick that up. We're here on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area, on HD Radio, and on irishradio.com. If you would like to hear this program again, please go to irishradio.com. And do stay tuned for the Adrian Flanelly Show, which is up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you who are coming to us on irishradio.com, do stay with us here until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht.